ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife. News breakdown.
And Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has wrapped up a two-day visit to Vietnam, celebrating 50 years of diplomatic ties and signing several agreements during the trip as Australia looks to strengthen diplomatic ties with the Vietnamese government. Notably, Australia will support Vietnam to transition to clean energy, with a $105 million package to help Vietnam combat climate change. Funding is going to support sustainable infrastructure planning and stimulated investment and so on. But of course, looming over the relationship is the backdrop of China's growing assertiveness in the Asia-Pacific region. Well, joining us again to discuss these issues, as well as the pardon and release of Kathleen Folbig and the imminent swearing-in of a new WA Premier, we have Sarah Eisen, federal political reporter with The Australian, and Sarah was formerly with The West Australian. Sarah, welcome again, and good evening to News Breakdown.
Good evening.
The Prime Minister sat down with his Vietnamese counterpart, Prime Minister Pham Minh Chinh, as well as the Communist Party General Secretary and other dignitaries. An amicable diplomatic mission would appear, doesn't it?
This is a pretty great trip for him, particularly given it's his first trip as the Prime Minister to Vietnam, particularly on the 50th anniversary of the Australian-Vietnamese relationship. It's definitely one of those countries that Australia does see particularly a lot more opportunity, but as you sort of foreshadowed there, as always, it's also about the influence in the region and who holds sway. So visits like this are really important.
Yes. China and Vietnam, of course, are neighbours, but also there's history there, and form too. In the past, they've been bitter enemies and rivals. Is the fostering of the relationship with Vietnam part of this counterweighting that's going on in the Indo-Pacific?
Yeah, I think broadly there is that kind of calculation going on across a lot of different regions, the Indo-Pacific, the Southeast Asian sort of region more broadly. What we did see just yesterday was some pretty remarkable figures from the Lowy Institute that showed that aid and development into the Southeast Asian region, which includes Vietnam, it was hugely, hugely propped up by China. China had almost 20% of all of that aid and financing really pumped into the region compared to Australia that accounted for 3%. Mm. So we're seeing these different ways of countries flexing their muscles and exerting influence. And of course, you know, putting money into countries for aid and development is a big, big part of that.
Yes, it is. It is. The PM did go to Hanoi via Singapore, and Richard Marles, Defence Minister, stayed on to attend meetings at Singapore's Shangri-La Security Conference. Now, on the weekend, he addressed the conference and then was questioned by an audience member who was a Chinese People's Liberation Army colonel who was in the audience and raised concerns about the expansion and intervention of military organisations like NATO. And the Defence Minister assured the gathering that AUKUS is not a new kind of NATO.
AUKUS is a technology transferring arrangement. It is not an alliance. It is, in the immediate term, through Pillar 1, a mechanism by which Australia can acquire a nuclear-powered submarine capability.
He also said he's haunted by whether or not Russia's war in Ukraine is a forewarning of the contest to come as China challenges America's global dominance. And, of course, hanging over all of this is the subject of Taiwan. What's being made, Sarah, of this rather direct contest between the Australian minister and the Chinese rep in Singapore?
Well, I mean, these sorts of things happen a lot, particularly when on the side of this sort of meeting, you always do have those ongoing contests in particularly the Taiwan Strait between Western countries and China, and you have these freedom of movement operations, which China gets pretty up in arms about. They don't like particularly America doing that. They're not a fan of Australia, America, and other Western nations coming close to their territories, and of course still think Taiwan is very much part of their country. So you do have these tensions always bubbling away in the background, and to this Shangri-La dialogue was no different. So those questions of who's posturing in what way, what something like AUKUS means in terms of if it is a direct threat to China, these are the sorts of things that it's the subtext to a lot of what's going on at these meetings. While really, our ministers are doing what they, want to do there, which is diplomacy. They're trying to make everyone happy, hose things down, make sure we all have those, strong ties, and sometimes diffusing some pretty awkward situations, as you heard there with that line of questioning to Richard Marles.
Yes, it's that's right. Australia has to tread carefully here, don't we, in how we're perceived in Asia in particular, Southeast Asia, and particularly amongst our supposed friends in the region as to what we're doing with AUKUS.
Yeah, absolutely, particularly because it does have that nuclear propulsion element. Mm. As much as Australia has made a lot of effort to ensure everyone in the region that it's not like nuclear arms, which would be very different, the nuclear propulsion still has concerned a lot of people, and that's, of course, what our submarines would be powered by. The whole point of a lot of the ties in the region and so on is, you know, nuclear non-proliferation and so on. So when Australia did sign this deal, we did see a lot of countries in the region have a bit of concern about that particular technology and power. Australia has been working pretty hard over the last few months to assure such countries that this isn't breaking any of those agreements and commitments regarding nuclear energy. But, of course, in the background, China's also made every opportunity to point the finger and say this is definitely in breach of what Australia has committed to when it comes to our treaties on nuclear.
Yep. All right. Nightlife News Breakdown. This is Sarah Eisen, federal political reporter with The Australian, formerly with The West Australian, which is relevant to our next topic, because I suppose that is the Labor caucus will meet tomorrow to officially vote for Roger Cook as its Labor leader, who will then, of course, become the next Premier of Western Australia, following the resignation, quite sudden and shock resignation, of Mark McGowan, who says he is, frankly, exhausted. Sarah, you've got a good knowledge of WA politics. You reported for the West Australian and grew up there. What's being made of the new Premier?
Well, I mean, it's the end of an era, isn't it? It's felt like Mark McGowan's been there forever, which of course he hasn't, but it just was such a huge legacy. And I suppose that is what's being made of Roger Cook. It's not that, you know, there's anything particularly wrong with the new Premier. It's just that for so long, it was Mark McGowan that was the face of WA, right? And I don't think that's hugely unique just to Western Australia. You know, you have someone like Peter Malinauskas now in South Australia, who's also a big brand of his own. But I think, you know, particularly in WA and just how popular McGowan was, and he became this real kind of personality, it is a little bit difficult for people to really comprehend who this person is. I think there's been some vox pops and some people in the streets and, you know, news organisation asking West Australians, well, what do you reckon of this new premier? What do you reckon of Roger Cook? And unfortunately, you know, quite a number of them will say, who is he again, kind of thing.
Of course, that's right.
And that's, you know, which isn't surprising. It's after this huge time that McGowan's had. So look, he doesn't come with a bad legacy or bad blood or anything like that, which is good. But for him to make a mark of his own, I mean, it's going to be a bit of a challenge. It's not an understatement to say he's got some big boots to fill.
So yeah, that's right. Yeah. I wouldn't think it's surprising, actually. I mean, you would know too from your own experience that premiers don't necessarily have the name recognition that they may certainly desire. I doubt that Chris Minns, the New South Wales Premier, has huge recognition in New South Wales. He's only new, after all. So maybe he'll get there, but Roger Cook's in the same basket. Essentially, if they run the shop in a tidy way and open and close on time, they usually will do okay, won't they?
Yeah, I suppose what's going to be interesting, and only time will tell sort of the answer to this question, but is how Roger Cook compares, right? So I think no matter what he does now in the next year or two, for better or for worse, I think just because of how popular McGowan was, and like I said, that real personality that people just got behind, there could be this sense of, oh, well, when McGowan was in power, this, or remember when Mark McGowan that. Like, that's just something that I think will be you know, a measurement that West Australians do use, at least in the short term.
every morning when he's shaving, he can look in the mirror and say, what would Mark have done?
What would Mark do? And, you know, I think, yeah, it will be a matter of what happens next in terms of some of the challenges WA faces, like a lot of the country, cost of living and health.
Yeah, and of course, interestingly, the yes case for the voice referendum may well have preferred to have Mark McGowan press their case. After all, WA and Queensland are seen as the two states more likely to favour a no vote at this stage. But in a way, the new Premier, because of reasons which many people are probably not aware of, might well be a positive for the yes case. Tell us how.
Well, Roger Cook's wife is actually Indigenous. It gives him this real passion as well, which he's spoken about even when he was, you know, for a long time deputy leader and so on. about racism internationally, but in Australia. And he does speak about that with a real personal touch, I suppose, that I do think actually means something if you have something that you can offer to a debate from your own personal point of view that seems really authentic, doesn't seem just like a political line, like they're just parroting the same as every other leader or the federal government. I think there is something to be said for how that will permeate to West Australians, which, as you said, they're one of the cohort that really do need some convincing, because WA and Queensland, I think, are of concern for the Yes campaign.
Yeah, that's right. The news poll wasn't a good result for the Yes proponents. What was it? Just run us through that for a sec.
Well, the news poll did see a drop in support for the Yes case, and it also does follow in line with the Resolve poll, I think, last month. It's now. So we are just seeing this incremental drop. We're seeing less than half of respondents intend to vote Yes. So it's the first time we've seen something like that. And it is being, taken, I suppose, by the Yes camp as not the end of the world. We're still quite a far away from a referendum. But it's not, the sorts of numbers that you'd ever want to see for something that's so monumental, And there is two schools of thought with this. One of them is the case is so far, the referendum is so far away, this is immaterial. And there's the other school of thought that's thinking, this is before it gets too intense or even nasty. It's before things have really fallen apart, if they are going to fall apart, so to speak. Like, this could actually be a time when people have this quite vague idea of what the Yes campaign or, the referendum could look like, and maybe just on some very basic ideas that they'd be supportive. But this early on, you have this real drop of support, and that's a quite bad thing. So I suppose it depends the sort of school of thought that you prescribe to, and probably also if you're a glass half full, glass half empty kind of person at this point. We do have a big campaign ahead of us, though, for both camps up until October at the earliest, and December at the latest is when we're expecting that referendum.
Yep. All right. Here's some good news. Tanya Plibersek, the Environment Minister, has said the government's going to triple the size of the Macquarie Island Marine Park. Macquarie Island is far away and remote and untouched and precious, and so this is the announcement that she made.
This is a home to incredible species like the penguins that I've been meeting this morning, but also seals and sea lions, whales and threatened birds like some of the albatross species. Many animals exist nowhere other than Macquarie Island and the waters around it, or they only breed on Macquarie Island or the waters around Macquarie Island. This is such an important addition to conservation. It's probably the biggest contribution that'll be made to conservation anywhere on the planet this year. We're tripling the size of the marine park and adding an area the size of Germany to the highly protected waters around Macquarie Island Marine Park. At the same time, we're allowing two fisheries that operate in the area to continue to operate in the way they've been doing for many years. These are sustainable fisheries catching Patagonian toothfish.
Yes, well, it's a huge area, and the Seafood Industry Association says they're not happy. Maybe that's predictable, was it, Sarah?
I mean, from what Tanya Plibersek is saying, there's not going to be that big much of a change to the operations of fishers and so on. So there is a level where, if it's not as big a deal as the government says, then maybe there wouldn't have been this outcry. But the peak seafood and fishing body has been highly critical of this group. Has been highly critical of this move. The main reason why is chiefly the consultation. We knew that they were a bit worried about this potential move back in February when Tanya Plibersek first said the government probably wanted to do this. Since that time, the Peak Group hasn't met with Tanya Plibersek. They say the Seafood Industry Association CEO says she has requested a meeting with the Environment Minister, but it just hasn't happened. So I think from their point of view, they just feel like there hasn't been the engagement that there should have been. They don't quite understand how this decision was made, on what basis and so on. And they're a bit worried about what that means for sort of future decisions when it comes to marine parks and decisions around the fishing industry and so on.
Yep. All right. Look, just before you go, the other big story today, of course, was this was essentially a New South Wales story because this is where the events took place and so on. But the release that today are following a pardon of Kathleen Folbig, a woman who accused, she's been in jail for 20 years, accused of killing her four children. She's been pardoned and released based on new scientific evidence that they may have died by natural causes. That's a reasonable doubt, says an inquiry. Although, as I say, she was convicted at a trial, and then again that conviction reinforced at a subsequent inquiry. It's quite a story, isn't it? How's it being received in Canberra?
Well, in Canberra, interestingly, we saw some peak organisations in terms of science organisations, so Australian Academy of Science and some other science industry groups, lauding this as like a win for science, because essentially what happened is after the fact, with new technologies and so on, it's been found that at least two of the four children who Ms. Folbig was accused of killing could have had this genetic mutation that really could have caused cardiac arrest and death. So I think similar to what we'd know as SIDS. Given that, it does cause reasonable doubt, which wasn't really something that was factored in back when she was convicted. So it means that this scientific evidence, this way of going back over genetic codes, this mutation, it has played into the justice system. It's put a reasonable doubt in this case, and it's changed the outcome of that way that justice was served. So from the science point of view, as I said, we heard from all these big science groups in Canberra, in Parliament House today. There was a number of press conferences. They've lauded it as a big win for their sector.
And yeah, I get that. Yeah, I get that. I get that. All right, Sarah, it's been terrific to talk. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yes, the New South Wales Attorney General Michael Daly pardoning Dianne Folbig on Monday. This is a bit of Michael Daly speaking passionately about how he came to his decision.
It's human nature to form a view and to make your own mind up based on what you know of any circumstance to form a view. But the evidence that's been put before Mr. Bathurst was voluminous. No ordinary citizens have that sort of volume of information or detail before them. So we just have to trust that the law did its job, that we had an eminent judicial officer in charge who reviewed that evidence and has come to a conclusion. There will be some people who have strong views. There's nothing I can do to disavow them of those views, nor do I, it's not my role to do that. We have to trust that the legal system in New South Wales is robust, that the rule of law is always obeyed and adhered to, and that was my dispassionate role as Attorney General. But I have to say, you know, we've got four little bubbas who are dead. We've got a husband and wife who lost each other. A woman who spent 20 years in jail, and a family that never had a chance. So you'd not be human if you didn't feel something about that, wouldn't you?
Yes, indeed. Michael Daly, the New South Wales State Attorney General, speaking there.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.